Welcome to WNZK, Dearborn Heights, Detroit, your ethnic superstation, 690 days, 680 nights.
This is Radio Ballady, broadcast every Friday here at WNZK Radio, 690 AM, hosted by syndicated columnist Ray Hanania and Layla Al-Husseini. Get information on show guests and topics by visiting RadioBallady.com. We want to hear your views. Call in during the show by dialing 248-557-3300. And now, Radio Ballady.
And good morning and welcome to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania. You are listening to Radio Ballady. Our website is RadioBallady.com. Our phone number, 248-557-3300. I want to thank our sponsors and also supporters like Radio Aramica, where you can listen to our radio show on your cell phone by dialing 712-432-8008. I want to get right into our first story because I'm really privileged to have two people who really have fought for justice just endlessly since the death of their daughter in 2003. Craig and Cindy Khoury, as you know, the Israeli judge in Haifa ruled against the Khouries, claiming that the death of their daughter in, I believe it was March 16th, 2003, was a regrettable accident. But of course, in order to make that decision, he had to hide behind several things, like claiming that her death occurred in a wartime situation. And the Israelis don't like to say that there's war when they kill Palestinians, you know, who are fighting with them, or when Palestinians fight against the Israelis, they claim it's terrorism. But when they end up killing somebody, it's always, well, you know, it happened because we're in a war. It's much deeper than this, and it's very tragic. But I want to welcome Craig and Cindy Khoury to our radio show. Craig, Cindy, thank you so much for calling us this morning.
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, Craig, can you hear me okay?
I can, and I regret to tell you that Cindy is not able to be here. We're actually, the family's still in discussion with our lawyers, which we've been doing pretty much all day today. It's 3 o'clock here in Haifa. But thank you for having me on the phone, and let's go forward from there.
Craig, we're very happy to have you on, and again, I appreciate, I know how busy you are because you are in the middle of, you know, reviewing what the judge did. But this is such an important case, and it's very kind of you to call us and share what happened with our audience in Detroit. But if you can, give us an idea of why did you feel that the judge, you know, what was his main argument, and how do you respond to what he said in his conclusion? How did you feel about what his verdict was?
Well, I don't want to give you, you know, in terms of legal arguments about this, because that'll have to be up to our attorneys in the weeks ahead. But so the judge ruled first and primarily that this was that Rachel was killed in an act of war, and that the state is not liable for what anything that happens in an act of war. So that is the overarching issue that makes this case far bigger than Rachel. There's
right.
A lot of things about it that, you know, are upsetting to a father, but that's the one that's upsetting to just a citizen of the world. And frankly, as a, I didn't want to be a soldier in Vietnam, you know, an old Army veteran, because there are citizens even in war. Well, let's just parse that for a second. First of all, what happened to Rachel happened in the Gaza Strip. So technically, that's not a war zone. That's occupied territory. And in an occupation under international law, you have an active duty as the occupier to protect the lives of all the civilians that are there, which would have included Rachel. So the overarching sort of thought that it's a war zone, in law, it is not. I think then the second part of that is that if you would accept that it was a war zone, citizens still have rights, and armies have to consider those rights, and so there's another step. Then, if you look at international law, as I understand it, and certainly as I was taught when I was a draftee back in 1969, I guess is when I was going to the Army training.
Right.
The rules around that, you look at the individual, the situation on the ground exactly the time you're talking about. So when I hear the military, the soldiers that were there on the ground testify in court that they felt no threat from Rachel or her friends, then I guess I would object to say that it's not like there's a firefight going on. Now, the state did say that there was a hand grenade thrown at the armored vehicles that were out there that day, but the people outside the vehicles, in other words, Rachel and friend, or as some person said a few days ago, of course, we can't ask Rachel, but her friends say there's no such thing. They did say there were some kids, some hundred or few hundred meters away that were throwing firecrackers, and they went over and asked them to leave. But there's no,
it almost sounds like it was an excuse.
Or vehicle would think there was a grenade being thrown, when the people outside that would actually be hurt by such a thing don't know what's happening. In fact, we think there was an entry in the operations log about a grenade being thrown, but we think it was actually the armored vehicles throwing out a sound grenade, that makes a big bang.
It sounds like the military was really, trying to make excuses. They always use, and there have been several incidents involving civilians where the Israelis said, the protesters were involved in terrorism. That was one of the judge's, claims against Rachel, that somehow she was associated with people who were involved in terrorism, because the home that was being destroyed was the home of a family who a member had been allegedly involved in terrorism. It just seems like a stretch, that they are putting up two phony walls. The one that, there was a terrorist threat, and two, hey, this is a war zone, and, the civilians shouldn't be there, so it's not our fault. It just sounds like they came up with two excuses to rule the way they ruled without being fair.
And it's more than two. So staying at the overarching sort of thing that you're talking about, they did go out of the way to try to malign the International Solidarity Movement, the group that Rachel was with. And I think in probably a U.S. court of law, my suspicion is none of that would have been heard by the judge. Now, in Israeli courts, there's no jury. So even if you want to argue that something shouldn't be heard by the judge, you're kind of out of luck, because you're arguing that it shouldn't be heard, and then he hears it. But the other part of that, you said that I think I heard you say that the Israeli military alleged that there was some sort of act of terrorism coming out of the home that Rachel was defending. And actually, the only thing that they have said is that, I believe in an affidavit that was submitted before coming to trial, but it's still really the initial testimony of Pinky Suarez, who was the brigade commander, the highest ranking operational Israeli soldier that came into the trial. I think he said that there had been a rocket fired at his troops from this home. But on cross-examination, he said, but it was after they had forced the family to leave the home. So they never alleged anything that was done by the family living in that house. They just simply said after they had dug around the house with their backhoes and destroyed the foundations and the electricity and the water, that then somebody had fired at it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I would remind the listeners, particularly out of Detroit, that the family, or at least the younger brother, his wife, and a baby that was born after Rachel was killed, came to Detroit. and talked with the people there, and along with Cindy and me. And to get to Detroit from Gaza, the first thing you have to do is you have to get a visa to come to the United States. To do that, the family had to come to Tel Aviv, to the embassy in Tel Aviv at the time, and apply for that. Even after their home was destroyed, Israel's government had nothing against this family. They gave them a pass to walk freely in the city of Tel Aviv for a day to get their visa in the United States government. And believe me, before they give a visa to a 34-year-old Palestinian, they check them out. They gave him a visa, and they flew to the United States. So neither United States nor Israel has anything against this family. They're just a family that happened to build a house close to the border with Egypt.
Right. We're on the line with Craig Khoury, the father of Rachel Khoury, who was killed in March of 2003. They just completed the court hearing. Craig, first of all, I think it was a victory for you that you were able to, after 9 years, I think it was, to get this finally into an Israeli court. That seemed to be an insurmountable challenge that you overcame. But the Israelis fought so hard to prevent this, it seemed. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, we filed the court case in 2005, so I believe it was on March 15th of 2005. You have a 2-year statute of limitations to bring a suit against the Israeli government for something that happened in the occupied territories. And 2 years may sound like a long time, you know, outside, but believe me, when you're in the process, it's a short time to make your decision. Up until that time, we had tried to rely on the U.S. government and diplomatic process to try to get some information and accountability for what happened to Rachel. So, for instance, immediately after Rachel was killed, the day after she was killed, President Bush talked to Prime Minister Sharon and was promised by Sharon a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing and a report to be given to the U.S. government. And then, I've forgotten exactly the time, but let's say a month to 2 months later, we heard through the news organizations that the Israelis had finished their investigation and that they'd found no fault with the bulldozer operators or the operation that went on that way, and had declined to give their report to the U.S. government. After that, eventually the deputy chief of mission in the embassy here and one of his associates, a person that worked for him, were able to read the report that was given by an attorney about why they would bring no charges against anybody. And after that, our family has read it and taken notes. So so all of that existed, but in June of 2004, so about a, you know, more than a year after Rachel was killed, we asked the State Department if they thought that that letter had indicated a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. And Colin Powell's chief of staff replied that he could say unequivocally that no, that did not indicate a investigation that was thorough, credible, and transparent. And in fact, it was the State Department that suggested that we should sue Israel and take them to court in Israel. So, and, you know, we ran out of time or any other option. So that is, a civil lawsuit is really the only process that as a family we can control and force to go forward.
Craig, I know you only have a little bit of time here because you are involved in something very important and you are taking time to share some of this information with our listeners to help us understand this. I'm assuming you're going to plan an appeal, and I wanted to ask you two questions. Obviously, do you have the choice to appeal in the Israeli courts? And two, have you thought about filing a lawsuit in the United States courts against Israel the way many Israelis have filed lawsuits against Palestinians in the U.S. courts, claiming that their, you know, family members were killed as a result of violence by Palestinians. Is that an option for you also?
Well, okay, we'll have to decide about the appeal here, and we are looking at it like I said. And so there's a process going forward here, and the overarching question of this idea that a nation's not responsible for what its military does as an act of war, I think people of conscience everywhere in the world need to oppose that. And so we have an opportunity to oppose that. And while it's it takes a lot of toll on the family to do that, I would expect us to go forward with that, and we'll just have to figure out how to do that. But that would be in Israel. In terms of trying to sue in the United States, we're told there were a couple of problems with that, and one would be that in the United States, Israel might have immunity from any lawsuit, and so attorneys had told us that it might be a $1 million lawsuit to figure out whether you could bring a lawsuit, and then you have the threats. Our assessment of that is that we wanted information. We wanted to be able to go through a discovery process and get whatever we could. I'm not sure how a discovery process in the United States would uncover documents and bring witnesses from Israel. So that was, an Israeli court would have, if they chose to be totally forthcoming in this, would have had the ability to get the information that we were seeking, I think. But at any rate, it seemed more straightforward. So
I think what you're doing is very important because it raises issues and helps people understand them more. For example, the whole issue of Israel having immunity in the United States is not an issue that would come up unless there was an unfortunate circumstance like this and somebody was challenging it. So I think you deserve a lot of credit for standing up to some of these issues and bringing them to light. There was no immunity against any of the Arab countries or Arab organizations in any of the lawsuits filed in this country. And to me, it shows how biased this system, unfortunately, can be, where we live as Americans. You served during the Vietnam War. I served during the Vietnam War. We're both proud to be Americans, and we often hope that our American justice system protects our American family members wherever they're at. It just, in my opinion, it seems like, Rachel is not getting, the same care and treatment for her case that others would have gotten, and you have to fight so hard to ensure that justice is achieved. That has to be a very difficult fight, and I admire you for doing it, and I wish there was some way that we can help, and I wonder, is there a way that people in the audience can help you continue this?
Well, I think it's stay tuned as far as that's concerned, because as we go forward, so far this financial costs as well as the emotional costs of this lawsuit, which is, of course, a civil suit, so had it gone successfully, at the end of the day, I guess there would have been money coming our way. But it was never about money, and it wasn't, that wasn't the idea of it. But we've borne the costs, and the attorney have not been paid for their time and the time of their legal staff. And as we look at an appeal, I don't think that we can continue to do that. And I think the reasons for appeal are far larger than Cindy and me. So we're going to have to look at a way to find outside funding for that. What I would tell you listeners to do right now is, for more information, because we have not been alone on this. For instance, Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center has jumped in and talked about this. The UN and Richard Falk at the UN has written an opinion about this. There's a lot of media coverage involved in all this, and you can see a lot more of it at the Rachel Corey Foundation website, and just go to the trial updates. Giving money to the foundation is a great thing, but it can't go, at this point, it can't not go to the trial. It could only, we do use the foundation to get educational material out about the trial, but not in the trial itself. I think that we'll look at some way to get a defense fund, or whatever you want to call it, put together so that our attorneys can be paid and the actual expenses of an appeal could be covered. But we just talked about that an hour ago. So I don't know if
Craig, and again, I
don't know how to do that. But the other place to go for updates on the trial and the information and for a lot of the media coverage, you know, links to it and stuff, is at the Rachel Corrie Foundation website. So that's RachelCorrieFoundation.org, or just Google Rachel, and, you know, it'd be one of the top things to come up. And it is amazing the amount of coverage that this case has now gotten and the amount of support that we're getting from people around the world. So I'm not sure exactly, you know, we don't know what's going on in the next half hour, but things are working forward. There are a lot of really wonderful people helping with us. I'm incredibly proud of our legal team. The generosity of the person that owns Haddad Guest House, where we're staying, to give me his phone and his line to the United States to call in on this. I'm sitting in his office. He's outside the office, having to do this. Just instant after instance of just plain folks going out of their way to support us and support this action. And, that's really gratifying and moving. And I just feel like we're on the right team, you know? Our attorneys are right. We have people reaching out. You know, if Jimmy Carter writes a statement in support, I'm gratified for that.
Yeah, we admire you, and I have to tell you that there's so many issues that have come up that are so important. To me, one of the most important is that Rachel Corrie was an American citizen, and we should, you know, stand up for her rights, if only because she was an American citizen, but in addition, because of all the issues that she was involved with. She was standing up for the rights of civilians. She was standing up, you know, for the rights of innocent people, and it's a horrible thing that happened. And I just can't imagine what I would do if this had happened, or anybody out there, what they would do if this had happened in their family. So if there's something, I know that people listening, if they can do to help you, they want to do it. And I know it has to be tiring and difficult for two parents, you know, to go through this the way you have. But what you've done is you've pulled the veil off of some of these issues that we've never been able to, you know the truth about. And I think that is important, let alone trying to get justice, which is so important to everyone, including your family and in your daughter's memory. Craig, listen, thank you so much for joining us this morning on radio. And we do wish you the best. You have a great family. Your daughter, it's a terrible tragedy. But so many people have come to know her and remember her. I think that's phenomenal.
Thanks, Ray. I sure appreciate your time and the time of your listeners. We'll keep bringing this forward. I don't, I'll just disagree with you for a second.
That's okay.
She'll be in a U.S. a U.S. citizen. We don't have rights in the United States that somebody else has. In the United States, we believe that these rights come, you know, that we have certain rights and all men are created equal. And now we know that that includes women and includes blacks and all that sort of stuff. That's what United States stands for. And I think that those rights, you know, I don't think that I have a right that a Palestinian or an Israeli Jew or somebody in Africa doesn't have, and they don't have rights that I don't have. You know, these are universal human rights, and we have to stand up for them. We have to stand up for them wherever they're challenged, whether that's in, inside the city in Detroit, whether it's, and when I was a kid, it was the Freedom Riders going down to the South in the United States, South Africa. You can point around the world in a thousand different places, unfortunately, where these rights are not secured for their people. But we need to stand up for them everywhere.
And I agree with you. Believe me.
I'll let you go.
Craig, no, listen, thank you. I totally agree with you, but if a person cannot stand up for their own, if an American can't stand up for Rachel Corrie, how could they ever be expected to stand up for the rights of innocent Palestinians or civil rights protesters in South Africa? You know, they need to stand up for themselves in order to be able to stand up for everybody else. But I agree with you 100%. Craig,
yes,
thank you.
There, Rick.
Thank you so much, Craig, for joining us. It really, again, is a pleasure, and we're gratified that you were able to give us some time.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Good day.
All right, that was Craig Khoury, the father of Rachel Khoury. He is in Haifa, and I believe he was in Haifa, where he was calling us from one of the offices there. He's with his lawyers, and they are looking at what to do next. They talked about some really important issues that were raised in this lawsuit involving their daughter. And very idealistic, that last point that we talked about. You know, these are things that we couldn't get to without this case. It isn't enough to just stand up for the rights of Americans. We've got to stand up for everybody's civil rights. But if you are American, and there are many Americans who are not standing up for the rights of an American named Rachel Khoury, how can they be expected to stand up for the rights of others if they can't stand up for her? So I think it's important. Anyway, we are going to take a break. This interview will be podcast, too, on our website at radioballity.com if you want to listen to it again. It was very important to hear his words directly. I'm Ray Hanania. This is WNZK AM 690. Our phone number is 248-557-3300. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking with you, the listeners, about Rachel Khoury and also the strange situation of Robert Fisk. Here's the guy who championed, you know, Palestinian rights so aggressively, and yet now it seems like he's taking the side of the Assad government in Syria, making excuses for the massacre in Daraa and suggesting that they were the result of, you know, the quote-unquote Syrian civilian terrorists rather than the result of the Syrian dictatorship and the Syrian military, which has imprisoned that country for more than 40 years. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Jake's Candy, 2-for-$1 candy bags and $1 candy bags available. Wholesale and distribution. Jake's Candy has been satisfying the sweet tooth of thousands of people for over a decade. Now providing delivery service to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio, as well as Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and New York City. For New York service, call Saleh at 718-213-1264. Or for more information, call Jake's Candy at 248-747-2223. That's 248-747-2223. 747-2223.
Whether it's makluba, warak diwali, tabbouleh, hummus, mensif, or any of more than 1,000 great Middle Eastern recipes, Ziad Brothers Importing is your best source for Mediterranean food products. Ziad Brothers Importing distributes products under the Ziad name and also many other labels, such as Sultan Extra Virgin Olive Oil and Dana Lebna and Dana Cheese. Try their ready-to-serve microwavable instant side pilafs, including couscous with tomato sauce, roasted green wheat pilaf, cracked wheat pilaf, and rice and lentil pilaf. All tasty, natural, healthy, and authentic Mediterranean dishes from the microwave to the table in minutes. Ziad food products are available at all major food and grocery stores in Dearborn, Chicago, Windsor, Canada, and around the country. If you can't find the product you want, just ask your grocer to stock them. For more information on food or recipes, visit Ziad Brothers Importing online at www.ziad.com. Ziad offers the best Mediterranean food products from our family to yours.
Good news. As of November 17th, Immigration has been given new instructions to review and close all pending cases. If you're in immigration proceedings, call attorney Stephen Lagana at 617-283-1018. Free consultation for Michigan residents. Mention Radio Bolity. For the latest in immigration law, Stephen Lagana specializes in immigration and federal court proceedings. Visas of all kinds, deportation, court appeals, open refugee status, and much more. All immigration cases are currently pending review. It's time to get the right attorney working for you. Call immigration attorney Stephen Lagana at 617-283-1018. Mention Radio Bolity. That's 617-283-1018. The American Muslim Center works for the community. It establishes goodness, virtue, and develops relationships between the Muslim communities as well as regional and national non-Muslim communities. The American Muslim Center on Outer Drive in Dearborn. Call 313-565-9314 or visit AmericanMuslimCenter.org.
And welcome back to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania here at WNZK AM 690. Our phone number is 248-557-3300. I think we have Edie on the line also. And I thought we also had Craig's wife, Cindy, on the line. But let's go to Edie on the line and welcome her to the radio show. And she's been holding for a while. Hi, Edie.
Morning, Ray.
And Edie, go ahead and give us some background because on this case, and tell us what your role is and how your organization has been helping, and you know, to get the word out, and just let us know. And I'm sorry that we kept you on hold that entire time.
No, that the first half hour was fascinating. No problem.
It's a very difficult topic, isn't it? Because you know, if we hadn't had this case, a lot of these issues wouldn't be discussed. You know, for example, that whole issue of Israel having immunity, you know, I mean, they bring lawsuits in the United States all the time. And to many people, they're wondering, why isn't there a lawsuit in the United States? Well, Craig, you know, answered it and basically said that they're not allowed really to bring a lawsuit against Israel in the United States. And to me, that's kind of shocking. And we would never have known that, I don't think.
Right. Well, I serve as the country specialist on Israel and occupied territories and the Palestinian Authority for the U.S. section of Amnesty International. And Amnesty International has had concerns about Rachel Corrie's death from the beginning, you know, issuing from back in 2003, where we were asking for a credible, thorough, and partial investigation. And we feel to this day Israel has still not come through with that impartial, thorough, credible investigation. And you're absolutely right. This case represents ramifications on many levels. One of the things Amnesty has been concerned about is this verdict has really upheld a very flawed military investigation system. We've been making criticisms on this flawed military investigation system for years. We saw it happened during Castled, the investigations that happened following Castled. The verdict has also had ramifications for the future. With no accountability for the Israeli military, it's really upholding and strengthening this environment of impunity for the military that's been going on for years. And I think it implicitly declares open season on any nonviolent activists in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, or really any civilian, because it's really chilling and cold when you hear people say that there's no such thing as a civilian in a war zone.
Right. And you know, another thing, Edith, and by the way, just for our listeners, Edith Garwood is the Middle East specialist, or a country coordinator specialist for Israeli occupied Palestinian territories, the Palestinian Authority for Amnesty International. And really, thanks to you, because Craig pointed out the media was now covering this, but before this trial, a lot of the information I received came from Amnesty International, not from the mainstream media. They only jumped on this, you know, when the ruling came out, and there has been some coverage. And I know Craig is happy about it, but I still don't feel the coverage even comes close. But one of the issues that I thought was important that's been raised as a result of all this and some of the issues that Amnesty has brought up is this idea that, you know, Israel claims that Rachel Corrie was killed in a war zone, and therefore the military has some types of broad protections because of that. Yet when a Palestinian is accused of engages in resistance, if in fact it's a war zone, a Palestinian therefore is engaged in resistance. Yet the Israelis then shift positions and say, no, this isn't a war, that's a act of terrorism by the Palestinian. So it's almost like they're taking two positions, you know, when it suits them. Is that clear, or am I misunderstanding something, do you think?
Well, the legal framework in that whole area is very difficult, and it's forever changing. But Craig was right on target when he was explaining that under Israel is an occupying power. And as an occupying power in the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, there are certain legal obligations they have. And
right.
One of the most important ones is to protect civilians in the area. And even if it is open hostilities or conflict, there are still certain rules of war that both Israel, any part of the parties involved in the conflict, have to abide by. And one of those is discrimination. You must still take every measure you can to protect civilians in the area. You can't just simply call an area a closed military zone or a war zone, and then, you know, civilians have no protection at all. That's just simply not true.
And we're on the line with Edith Garwood. And Edith, how is your time? Are you able to stay on with us for about maybe 15, 20 minutes?
Yes, sure.
Okay, thank you so much. And I know with Craig on the line, it was hard to bring a second caller on because he was long distance, and sometimes there are always these phone issues. But we do have callers that would like to call and ask questions and maybe comment, and maybe we can take some of those calls at 248-557-3300. We have Edith Garwood from the Amnesty International, which is a very important organization that's done so much to bring light to a lot of issues, not just in the Middle East, but all over the world. So we're very privileged to have Edith on our show. We have Sam on the line with a comment and a question. Sam, go ahead. You're on with Edith Garwood.
Yeah, hi there. You guys mentioned Robert Fisk. I'd just like to say a couple things about that. He's been in the area for about 30 years. I think he knows what's going on over there. He's been covering all the wars in Lebanon, Iraq, now Syria.
Oh, that was from an earlier. That, just so we know, that's not Edith that was talking about Robert Fisk. But that was me, and that was a topic that I wanted to talk about too. But listen, you can call back on that one. But, Sam, do you have a comment on Rachel Khoury first?
Well, definitely, I feel sorry for her and for her parents. I think justice is not done yet. So that's all I have for that. But if you just give me just a couple minutes,
Go ahead, Sam.
So anyway, I think Robert Fisk knows what's going on more than us here in the States. The second issue is we keep calling these rebels freedom fighters. I think they're nothing but most of them. I'm not saying all of them are Islamic fanatics, and Al Qaeda have as written all over them. They've been killing a lot of people, especially the minorities in Syria. Now, the American people needs to understand that, you know, a lot of people are coming to Syria from Libya, from Saudi Arabia, in the name of, you know, Islamic fanatics. So there's a lot of killings from the Assad regime. I'm not defending them as well. But I think they're the better of both evils. So,
I don't know. It sounds, Sam, again.
I have people living in the area. We talk to them. They know what's going on more than us over here. So I think there's a great picture that we don't see the truth, and we keep talking about these people as rebel fighters. I don't believe they're rebel fighters.
I'll tell you, Sam, my only disagreement with you is this, that the Syrian government has banned journalists from going into their country, except they escorted this one reporter into Daraa. They allowed him to go in. Now, you and I know the government would not have allowed him in unless they knew he was going to whitewash and defend what they were doing. So they can't have it both ways. Either they should let all the journalists in so we can find out what the truth is, or admit that they're manipulating it. That's my point. But, Sam, listen, I respect your opinion. I want to move on because I want to focus on Rachel a little bit, but I thank you. But you made a very important point, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sam. Edith, you know, we only have an hour to go through a lot of big topics here in Detroit. So we're going to be focused on so many different things, and I don't want to distract you from the Rachel Khoury issue. How significant is what happened in this court case in terms of the fight for justice in a case involving, you know, civilians under Palestinian occupation?
Well, I think it's very difficult. Rachel Khoury highlights just, and her family repeats this often, just what has happened to thousands of Palestinians. And they really it's very difficult for Palestinian civilians that have had, violence done against them in the occupied territories or who have been killed. It's very difficult for their families to bring a suit to even try to follow up on on the incident of where they've been injured or killed. A lot of times, especially from Gaza, they need permission to be able to even enter Israel to testify in court. Lawyers from Gaza can't represent the clients before Israeli courts. Israeli lawyers can't enter Gaza to meet with their clients there. There's steep court fees. I mean, the Corys are really spearheading an effort representing more than simply the case of their daughter. They're representing and trying to draw attention to this whole flawed system that's happening there in the territories. And they're also trying to draw attention to the reason she was in the Gaza Strip to begin with. Because at the time that Rachel was protesting there in the Gaza Strip, 1,700 homes had been destroyed and 17,000 people left homeless. Demolitions and forced evictions is a serious issue that's even going on to this day in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, especially now, and in Area C of the West Bank.
And how, you know, Amnesty International, I think, is an organization that does so much to bring light to many of these, you know, dark incidents that occur across the country. It must be very difficult to, I mean, personally, I'd feel great to stand up for these principles, but sometimes you must feel like you're up against a brick wall, like, you know, in the United States with some of these issues. A lot of people just don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear criticism of Israel. They don't want to hear, you know, what the truth is about Rachel Khoury. What is that like for you and for Amnesty trying to, you know, educate people about the reality of, you know, fighting for civil rights and justice?
Well, I can't really speak for Amnesty as an organization. I don't think it has feelings. But
well, I mean, you know, just the people that you work with.
Right, right. Well, speaking for myself, I've been actually working on this area for 3 decades. And yes, in many ways it's discouraging because over the years you see the situation on the ground just deteriorate. And it's frustrating. You don't feel like you're making any progress. But on the same hand, when I look at the situation or the environment we live in today versus when I started looking into these things, there was no internet. You actually had to go to a card file in a library and look up books. And then books that didn't exist. And in today's environment, it's very encouraging to see, especially the younger generation, I think because of social media and email, and it's easier to travel, and you've got digital photography and videos, so information is easier to share. Or if there's an official narrative coming from the government, if you've got photographic evidence that directly contradicts that, they can see it immediately. It's very encouraging to see that the younger generation now is much more knowledgeable about the issues and what's going on over there than, say, my generation was 30 years ago. And even the older folks like me that may have just learned about this issue, say, 5, 10, 15 years ago, have access to information that they just didn't have access to before. So on the one hand, the situation continues to deteriorate, and that's very discouraging. But I also see a whole scores of people out there that have knowledge about this that they just simply didn't have before.
You must have your Amnesty International and especially the Middle East section must have its hands full with all the things happening, though, today. I mean, how tough is it to, you know, bring out the story with all the protests? I mean, for example, you know, what's happening in Syria, you know, the some cases we seem to focus on, and then incidents in some Arab countries like Bahrain, they only get, you know, treat, you know, some exposure, not a lot. That has to be pretty challenging.
It is, and you might be familiar with Amnesty International's structure, but it's kind of a unique hybrid organization where you've got volunteer leaders that are unpaid, they're members working within the organization alongside the paid staff. And we have the research team that's located in London that travels to the region. Donatella Rivera is our senior researcher on crisis response that was actually able to get into Syria and document things that are going on there. And she was also the lead researcher for CASLED back in 2008, 2009. And she was also one of the lead researchers in Libya during that, the hostilities going on there. And then you have what's happening in our section. We have someone in Washington that I just admire very much. His name is Sanjeev Berry, who's able to get out actions on Bahrain and question the U.S. government on why they're not hitting a harder on our ally there. And he's also works closely with me on actions on Israel and occupied territories. And as far as the volunteer, what's called a coordination group on the Middle East, the folks there have been there in those positions for years and worked diligently. And yes, especially at times of crisis, it can be a 20-hour-a-day job for months on end.
And I think they can pay a high price in terms of, you know, trying to be the voice of justice in a environment sometimes that's very hostile. I think it's important for the audience to remember that a lot of the people with Amnesty are volunteers, and that, you know, you're really pursuing a higher truth at a great expense, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe a personal, you know, expense, you know, to your own life. And I admire what you do. I think it's very important. And I think it's important for the public to recognize that sometimes, because they just hear Amnesty International, like any organization, they assume, well, you know, it must be easy. It doesn't sound easy at all.
No, actually, even the volunteer members can suffer from PTSDs. We've had folks that have worked on issues and watching videos of some of these things that happen.
That has to be horrible sometimes.
Yes, but, you know, on the other hand as well, I've had people say, how can you continue to work on these issues, especially Israel and occupied territories? It doesn't seem to be doing any good. And I tell you that actually it's very cathartic. If I didn't have a chance to actually do something about this and to call people out or challenge things like this verdict on Rachel Corey's death, then I'd probably be, you know, yelling at the TV all day long. But that's, I think, why Amnesty International volunteers do what they do, is they can actually see tangible results from their efforts. They believe in the principles of universal human rights and basic human rights, and Amnesty allows them to have that outlet and make a contribution to the effort.
Edith Garwood is my guest from Amnesty International, covering Israel and the Palestinian territories. Edith, is there a website that you would direct people to go to where they can go not only to get information, but even to help and support Amnesty International and what they're doing?
Well, our website for the U.S. section is amnestyusa.org. And on that website, they'll be able to look at the homepage and go to the latest statement that we had issued on Rachel Corey. And also at the top of the webpage, there's something they can click on for the blog. And several blogs have been written lately by different people within the organization. There's one called Rachel Corey, Michael J. Fox, and the Right to Housing, which takes a really good look at why Rachel Corey was in the Gaza Strip at that time and doing what she was doing. Because part of the verdict when it came down, laid no responsibility on the Israeli military, but put some responsibility on her for being there in the first place.
Right.
Any rational person would have left.
That's really, you know, that's the kind of thing that offends me, that, you know, without voices like yours, without Craig and Cindy Kurian standing up, you know, for this, without the ISM, without many of the activists, things would be turned around to make it look like the victims are the people creating the problem. And I think that you help shed a light on that is so important, Edith. I'm just very proud that you're able to take a minute and call us and talk to us a little bit. It's obviously not a lot of time to get into the depth of all this, but unfortunately that's a sad part about our media. In the U.S., we just don't have the resources to really get into depth, and many times the media doesn't even properly cover some of these stories. So anytime I can help give you a voice, I'm more than happy to do it. So please keep me in mind for any future developments on the Rachel Corey case or any other issues that you're involved with. If you want to help, need help getting that out to the public in Detroit and in Chicago, I would love to help you out.
Well, I do appreciate that, because I feel like Amnesty in the U.S. can help get out that voice, like Craig was saying, of the victims, whether they be Israeli or Palestinian, to get out that voice here in the U.S., which mainstream media doesn't always cover.
Edith, thank you so much for joining us, and it was very kind of you to wait on the line. I really appreciate what you're doing, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's Edith Garwood of Amnesty International's unit that covers Israel and Palestinian territories. I'm Ray Hanania. You're listening to Radio Ballady. It is 49 minutes after the hour. Our website is radioballady.com. We'll have this podcast of the Rachel Khoury story, the interview with her father, Craig Khoury, and the interview that we just completed with Edith Garwood of Amnesty International's Israel and Palestine section. Very informative and only just scratching the surface of some very important issues. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we can take a few more calls at 248-557-3300 if you want to talk about Syria or if you want to talk more about Rachel Khoury, any of those topics. 248-557-3300. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Icon Computer Megastore. Mention Radio Baladi for great deals. Computers and laptops from $99. Apple computers from $129. Warranties included. Shipping available. Free layaway plans. Arabic to English keyboards, $5. Mouses, $5. Repairs for iPods, iPads, Apple computers, and PCs. Icon Computer Megastore on Greenfield, north of Warren Avenue in Dearborn. Mention Radio Baladi. Call today, 313-582-3100. 313-582-3100.
SevilleMedia.com is a wellspring of media arts. SevilleMedia.com tells God's story through short films, drama, poetry, music, and the internet. And you have free media downloads. Go to SevilleMedia.com and listen to Nasheed, based on the Psalms of the Prophet David, for free downloads in several Arabic dialects of stories, short films, poetry, and music. Go to SevilleMedia.com.
Jake's Candy, 2-for-$1 candy bags and $1 candy bags available. Wholesale and distribution. Jake's Candy has been satisfying the sweet tooth of thousands of people for over a decade. Now providing delivery service to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio, as well as Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and New York City. For New York service, call Saleh at 718-213-1264. Or for more information, call Jake's Candy at 248-747-2223. That's 248-747-2223.
Whether it's makluba, warak dawali, tabbouleh, hummus, mensif, or any of more than 1,000 great Middle Eastern recipes, Ziad Brothers Importing is your best source for Mediterranean food products. Ziad Brothers Importing distributes products under the Ziad name and also many other labels, such as Sultan Extra Virgin Olive Oil, and Dana Lebna and Dana Cheese. Try their ready-to-serve microwavable instant side pilafs, including couscous with tomato sauce, roasted green wheat pilaf, cracked wheat pilaf, and rice and lentil pilaf. All tasty, natural, healthy, and authentic Mediterranean dishes, from the microwave to the table in minutes. Ziad food products are available at all major food and grocery stores in Dearborn, Chicago, Windsor, Canada, and around the country. If you can't find the product you want, just ask your grocer to stock them. For more information on food or recipes, visit Ziad Brothers Importing online at www.ziad.com. Ziad offers the best Mediterranean food products from our family to yours.
And welcome back to Radio Radio Ballady. Radio Chicagoland is my Sunday show in Chicago. If you want to listen to that, you can go to RadioChicagoland.com. I was just typing out a note of thanks to Edith Garwood of Amnesty International and also Craig and Cindy Khoury. Craig Khoury taking the time to call us. They are in the Middle East. And they were able. Craig was able to give us an update on what was happening. So I wanted to make sure I got that thank you out to them, because I really felt really moved by the story. Their story is just a phenomenal story, real tragedy and sad. Our number is 248-557-3300. We only have a couple minutes. We may next week, I think, talk about Robert Fisk. And, you know, Robert Fisk has done a lot of great columns exposing the tragedy of the Palestinians under Israeli occupation. But that whole Palestine war conflict with Israel has become a dividing line in the Arab community in the United States and also even in the Middle East. And there are different dividing lines between Syria and the rebels that are fighting, the resistance that's fighting Syria. So part of it is that a lot of people that are supporting Syria are supporting Syria even though the government is killing civilians, you know, men, women, and children in Syria. And yet they're closing their eyes to that injustice because they believe that Syria is an important component in the fight with Israel for Palestinian justice. So they are reluctant to criticize the Syrian government, and they want the Syrian government to succeed, or they don't want it to be overthrown. They want it maybe to be morphed, but they're not happy with the resistance. And they've been doing everything they can to cast the resistance as if they're some kind of terrorist, blaming the resistance and the pro-democracy movement as being responsible for the massacres of civilians that have taken place in many of the cities. And I singled out Robert Fisk because in his columns over the last couple of days, he was taken under the arm of the PR spokesperson for the government of Syria, and he was allowed with a Syrian military escort to enter Daraa, where this massacre of hundreds of civilians took place. And how would you expect him to report? You know, that would he be fair to report, you know, that the Syrian military was responsible when in fact the Syrian military escorted him into the city? I don't think so. I think they escorted him into the city because they believed he was going to be writing positive things about the Syrian government. And that concerns me, especially when the Syrian government has banned all other journalists from entering, you know, their country. In other words, if the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad really wants the public to know the truth about what's happening in Syria, they should let the media come in cover the event, to cover the event, openly without censorship or restriction. But the Syrian government isn't doing that. They're being selective. And you know that when they select somebody, it's not because they expect that person to be objective. So in this case where we're involved, this isn't just politics where you could be biased in favor of one or you're working for a government, you know, and I do that as a media consultant. I work for clients. Now, I won't work for a client if I don't believe in them, but I certainly wouldn't work for a client when it involves, you know, the massacre or killing of people, you know, in the Middle East. So to me, that's a major issue. I would be ashamed to be a journalist to have been escorted into Syria by the Syrian military and then told, go ahead, you can write the story, because I don't know. I don't think Robert Fisk would be writing an objective story. So that kind of bothered me a little bit, and maybe we'll talk about that. We'll get some journalists on the line next Friday to explore this issue of, you know, the Syrian government has really stepped up its communications through social media. And also they have a new communications director in Damascus. Many of the leaders in Syria have been killed. And these are the people that have been massacring, you know, civilians over the years. And now they've been punished. So Bashar al-Assad in his speech really sounded like a very, very desperate person. So we may talk about that, I think, next Friday here at Radio Bellity. I want to thank everybody for listening. It's not about whether you agree or disagree. It's about having a discussion about these issues, because I always allow everyone, no matter what your opinion, to express your opinion as long as you're respectful to other people, their race, religion, and their nationality. Thank you so much for joining me here at Radio Bellity. Remember our website, radioballity.com. You can go there to get the podcast and more information on how to reach us. Have a great weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and we will talk to you next Friday. Bye-bye, everybody.
WNZK has available a few good hours of airtime for a few good